best of the 60s. You could say the best of the 60s.
Yeah, yeah, you could.
Yeah, and Ian has said about me, Bob is not very extraordinary in his mind. He's never had original thought in his head. I get a total put down from Ian. But then I know that that's a compliment, because Ian says that ascension is not a thinking man's game, and I can't think, so I'm well on the way, and that's why Ian showed up to me. So I have the energy of questioning, but I have no clue what, anything about the answers. I'm just good at keeping the questioning going.
Yeah, that's what Carolyn's there for, right?
That's right. Yeah. You will hear that in the private sessions. Carolyn doesn't have to ask questions. Ian pours everything out to Carolyn. You know, no questions asked. You just, maybe a couple of clarifications, but Carolyn doesn't have to pull it out of him. I have to pull it out of Ian often.
Right. You don't think, and Carolyn does. That's why.
Yes, and also maybe Carolyn can understand Ian, especially in her field, faster than I can. I don't get it right away, so I have to find out what the fuck they just said, so it does get slowed down. But for other people, the questions are good that I come up with, you know, because they don't get it either. They need questions.
Listen, Bobby, I've known you for a long time, and I always love the fact that you're relentless in your questioning.
Yeah, as a kid, they used to complain about me. Why are you always asking why? You know, this is like an 8-year-old telling me this.
Right,
I'm 8.
Right.
And he says, you're always asking questions. I think that I was not even human, and I was faking being human. I had nothing to say, so I had to fake it by pretending I was interested. And I thought asking questions indicated interest in what the person said.
Right.
Well, yeah, and there's a good boost for culture, because that's true.
Yes. And Greg Skinner, he met me in 75 at the Art College Loft and First in New York City, the Halifax Art College Loft. And he just hitchhiked in from California. He'd been a student at the college in Halifax. So he got to meet Nam June Paik, John Cage, a whole bunch of other, Ken Kesey, Paul Krasner, through me, those couple of weeks he was staying at the loft when I was there. In April, May 75. And so all the people that he studied or heard about at art school in the early 70s, he never had any access to them until he met me. Okay, so he met them all in New York through me, because I knew where they all were, and I would go to whatever they were doing and interact with them. So he was really appreciative of that. But he said the thing he learned from me was that no matter how dumb the person is talking to you, if you ask questions about their dumb topics or whatever they're talking about and show an interest, it actually is profitable. So my technique of asking questions can prove useful in your social fatic, boring life.
Yep.
Amen.
Amen. And asking questions is the finest way to derail an aggressor.
That's right. Yes. And let's see, what would be the opposite of that? It's the finest way to derail a passive-aggressive person.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Show interest in their ridiculous self.
Exactly.
Another indication of my ability to do that, when Eldridge Cleaver, Tim Leary, Paul Krasner, Abby Hoffman, all those people in the 60s came to Ryerson one time in 1985 or so. So Ian Arlett and I went to the panel, and it was a very good, interesting panel. Eldridge Cleaver, the black activist, had become a born-again Christian, pro-Reagan. Yeah. He freaked everybody out. So they all presented their stuff and argued in that. And then after, on the stage, a guy comes up to me, a loser, nerdy-looking guy, And I get talking to him, because I'll talk to anybody, and he turns out to know about Spotlight magazine. He was a reader of Spotlight, which is a far-right wing, anti-Semitic bullshit place, thing, which was but still pretty good in what it showed, is top-down facts or fake facts. Anyways, here was his somebody in Toronto. I was getting the Spotlight. He was getting it. So we were talking about it. After a while, Ian comes over, and he drags me away from the guy. He says, "You're missing the fucking interaction with Abbie Hoffman, for fuck's sake, Bob. Get over here and listen to Abbie Hoffman," you know, which I would have liked to have done. And he drags me over there, and that's right when Abbie Hoffman finished. So I missed Abbie Hoffman because I was talking to an idiot, far-right, anti-Semitic guy.
Right.
And because I was interested in him, you know, like, it shows you my personality. I look for the stuff in the fringes. In the ignored places.
Well, yeah, cool.
And all those ignored places are now archetypal. You have to realize how much Zappa was ignored, how much McClune was ignored, and Mae Brussel, LaRouche, they're all ignored completely. Huh? And nobody ever heard of them who was around back then.
Now they're halfway to beatification.
Yeah, every one of them.
Yep.
Even LaRouche. LaRouche is celebrated in China because he predicted the Belt and Silk Road.
Oh, that's cool if that's true. If they're like, hey, who are our few like allies on this in the West? And
right.
If he's actually on their radar, that's cool.
Well, he is ill, or he's just not out there in the public as much, so his wife is. And she is often on Chinese TV as the top lady from the West who understands the development of the Belt and Silk, because LaRouche was writing about it and proposing it 25 years ago.
Right.
So there's okay. So he's persona non grata in North America, but he is celebrated in a, you know, culture with 2 billion people or whatever it is. That's well, why does he have to be popular here and go to another part of the world? And make it.
Yeah, right. I mean, he's always less popular than I, you know, feel like he ought to be. But he does have a little bit of a popularity or a respect, or sometimes a grudging respect or a slowly growing respect in the conspiracy or parapolitics world.
Right.
As people, you know, I mean, when people are introduced to the fact that, like, this guy was ahead of the curve on, you know, just a lot of the topics about, like, you know, they made a movie about Gary Webb, but Lyndon LaRouche came out with Dope Inc., like, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And they, all the Alex Jones world is LaRouche replayed.
Right. Well, it's amazing that The Simpsons made... They, you know, name dropped him always in a mocking way or whatever, but they name dropped Lyndon LaRouche. You know, he was like the Alex Jones or something of The Simpsons, but with his own way, you know, I mean, because it was someone who was running for president. And,
yeah.
I mean, there's that one point where Homer famously says, "Oh my God." He's like, or he doesn't say, "Oh my God," but he says, "Lyndon LaRouche was right."
Many people, by 2000, once everybody got on the internet and then was reading all this conspiracy stuff, it seemed to be the main genre for people. They learned about that stuff that they wouldn't have without the internet. I met a lot of people throughout 2000s say, you know, that LaRouche guy, man, he was ahead of his time. He was right. You know, I've heard many people say this. And somebody said, why isn't LaRouche the big hero? Why Alex Jones? Well, it's because people don't read, right? And LaRouche is mainly a journalistic operation, a news network. But they, so I'm in touch with them, and they just sent me a whole bunch of his books that the group of them did over the last 20 years, or well, maybe, yeah, 15 years. A lot of interesting books, and they did a new update of Dope Inc. They've done many, but.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, and you look through it, they got graphs, they got incredible detail. If journalism is obsolete, they're the monks of journalism. They still track everything.
Right. They have that vibe.
Yes. And
they have that monkey vibe, you know.
Yeah, and they sent a magazine all about Mueller, Robert Mueller, you know, trying to have a coup against Trump. And they're an expert on Mueller because Mueller is the guy who put LaRouche in jail in the 80s.
Right.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so I'm looking through the magazine. It's all this data about Mueller, what an asshole he was in the 80s and dealing with LaRouche. You know, all that historical stuff from 30 years ago is in the first part of the magazine.
Wow.
Nobody else knows that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
So he put LaRouche away, and he was rewarded. He got to replace J. Edgar Hoover. He became the new director of the FBI because he took on the toughest hombre in the town. He took on LaRouche and whooped him.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
There's a famous quote by LaRouche. History. What?
Just he's got a long history, Mueller, yeah.
Yeah.
People don't know.
And you imagine if you're taking over Hoover's role. I don't know. What do you know? What do you have to do? And but so LaRouche, way back in the 70s, said, there's going to be no revolution in the United States without me. Okay? So they have that quote. No revolution without LaRouche, says LaRouche. And then beside it is Henry Kissinger going, LaRouche is persecuting me. Two great quotes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was looking at a dialogue, an interview with Christopher Hitchens, the late Christopher Hitchens, and he did a big book on Kissinger. And he had some interesting things to say. That's his proudest book because, you know, we have these international justice courts and only losers get taken up, like Slobodanovic or whatever his name was of Serbia or Yugoslavia and the guy in Chile. Pinochet, they get hauled up to these courts because they lost their wars and they're found guilty. And so Christopher says the most important question for our time is, can we take the people who represent democracy and fight around the world for democracy, the United States, and take one of their guys and be a war criminal? Is that possible? And he says, Kissinger, there's so much data against Kissinger. If he was not, you know, in charge of the United States, he'd be immediately hung and quartered. If you put his stuff
right
before an international tribunal,
yeah.
So that's an interesting point of Christopher Hitchens. Of course, LaRouche thinks Hitchens is pure British propaganda, part of the Fabian Socialist Network grouping that came out of the '60s. It's interesting the debate between LaRouche and Hitchens.
Mm.
You know, I interviewed Bill Weinberg. You might have heard that one, the activist in the Lower East Side. He specializes in saving Aboriginal groups and third world minority cultures. I was going to bring up LaRouche, or it got brought up. And he says, that's a whole other topic. I can't go into that because Bill Weinberg is part of the gang in New York City that fought with LaRouche since the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so you can't bring up LaRouche to them.
Well, yeah.
As a matter of fact, you know, LaRouche made that statement about the British Empire, or the British, you know, having a coup against Trump. And, of course, the British means the financial oligarchy of the City of London in LaRouche terms. So this leftist guy in Toronto, I posted on his page. He says, you can't put that crap on my page. And I said, did you read it? He says, yeah, I read the first sentence and I vomited. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
LaRouche is a leftist. In many ways, he's a leftist. And he's an expert on the history of leftism and Marxism and all that. And yet the lefties can't take him. They really don't see any value in what he does. But he names the names in, like, whatever happened this past week that you haven't even know about, they've already put out a press release on whoever got named in this week's stories with their history going back 50 fucking years of what they all did.
Right.
you know, instant amazing journalism.
At least it's like, you know, if I mean, there's this big demand for undermining Mueller's credibility, but like, who has a big long article about this guy's history of
bullshit? Yeah,
you know, bullshit. It's the LaRouche folks.
That's right. And so Reiner, you get Reiner and those guys up in Buffalo with that critical art ensemble, and they get the little books out of Semiotex Press or that press in Brooklyn, Autonomedia in the art schools. These guys have a nice little book. You've seen Steve's book, right, Reiner?
Yeah.
You know, they have nice little books. It gets distributed to the universities and the art schools. And those kids have no clue of the real underground in terms of very interesting information that a naturally critical art student would be interested in. That comes from LaRouche, but they're not allowed to even be mentioned in LaRouche land. I went to the School of Visual Design or something like that on 14th Street in New York. They had a big panel and had all the art professors there. This is back about 2005 or so. And I'm in the audience, and they lay out their stuff, the art world's archetypes. And I said, I stood up and I said, all that you're saying needs to be backgrounded by William Irwin Thompson and Marshall McLuhan and Arthur Croker and Lynn LaRouche. Immediately a professor says, well, I agree with all your names except for LaRouche. Do not mention LaRouche.
Yeah, that sounds like U.S.
art school. But you don't get that objection in Toronto. They know nothing about LaRouche. Never heard of him.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, exactly, yeah. He's not even verboten up here. He's who?
No, he's
whatever. I don't know about up here, but these days, whatever, I don't know, among most normies or whatever.
Right, like that's why.
No more penetration.
That's why it was fun doing LaRouche on CKLN. Because nobody knew nothing about him, so there was no objection. So there were a lot of people say, oh, I like that LaRouche stuff. I like the executive intelligence review, the dumb Torontonians would say. and then eventually, when we played our long interview with LaRouche, the only people who could know and would know are is the Jewish Defense League or whatever the Jewish defense mechanism is in Toronto. They called up and complained to the station for allowing LaRouche to be broadcast.
Wow. Yeah, right.
They're the only ones. Okay, is there something else we could talk about, Reiner? Come on, Reiner, come up with something.
I'm waiting for that 4X thing. I'm getting tired now. It's like early in the morning here now, right? So I'm getting to the point where I got to think about hitting the sack soon.
You're a harassed bureaucrat. From September, October, you're a harassed bureaucrat. Got to deal with all these kids. You got to talk to everybody every day, right? Figure out their courses.
Yep. And a lot of grad students. So, yeah, you know, they kind of wear me down for the first month. And then I settle in and don't give a shit anymore.
So you are a teacher of grad students.
Yeah, I teach undergrad and grad, yeah.
Oh, and where do you stay during the week in Buffalo?
No, I still commute back to Grimsby.
You go back every day, every night?
Yeah.
Well, how many hours is that ride?
It's only an hour. It's like super easy. I mean, I never have any traffic issues, and it's never a problem. It's super fast.
So well, okay, that's lucky.
Better than trying to get to Toronto when I did things in Toronto. It can take you 2 to 3 hours to get.
That's right.
An hour ride. So we're going back into Buffalo. Is super easy.
Did you ever hear me explain that the bad traffic? You know who caused that?
Mm-hmm.
In Toronto.
No.
McLuhan.
Why? Because he fought the Spadina Expressway.
That's right. Nelson Thal and I, we'd be driving around Toronto in the 80s or 90s and be stuck in a traffic jam. And Nelson, you know, who promoted McLuhan a lot, he'd sit back and go, Just think, that's fucking McLuhan. He caused this.
He stopped that expressway, yeah.
Yeah. It might have ruined Toronto, but there wouldn't be the horrible traffic jams, though some people say, nah, there'd still be terrible traffic jams. Spadina wouldn't have fixed anything. So,
well,
somehow it didn't occur to them.
Yeah. What are you saying, Brian? What didn't occur to them?
Somehow it didn't occur to them to just build the damn highways like 10 lanes or whatever, just more than, you know, three or four.
Right. They
like
thought.
Just that there was a vision that, like, we'll never need more than four lanes. Like, now we're like, we can't expand them anymore, damn it.
Right. Okay, so we've got Anonymous, we got Sean, and we have our McLuhan Pomo scholar, Jason. You must be inspired by our conversation, Jason. You must have something to say.
Did you call me a homo?
Yeah, I called you a homo.
No Pomo.
I said Pomo. P.
Oh, Pomo.
Okay, you homo fucker. What do you have to say? Oh, nobody. Pomo? You don't know what Pomo means?
What does Pomo mean?
Postmodern.
No. Oh, Pomo. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you're the postmodern. You're the only guy who's read Deleuze and Croker and Baudrillard and these things. The only guy here.
Virgilio, he passed away.
Yes, yeah. And you know what?
Yeah.
About a week ago, walking home from the beach, and I said, you see, I just stocked up on all my Virilio books. I just bought a whole bunch 2 months ago just to complete my Virilio library because, you know, he was talking back to McLuhan. And so I was just thinking, he's pretty old. I wonder if he's going to die soon.
86.
So I was thinking that. And I come home, and then about 7 days later, I found out he did die, and that he died around the day I was thinking of it. So there's my ESP. I hadn't thought about him too much. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking about him dying, and because he came to me after he died. Hey, Bob, I'm dead. Talk to me, Bob. Talk to me.
Wow. I cut his picture out of a magazine just a week ago.
Oh, we missed it, Brian. What did you do?
I cut his picture out of a magazine a couple weeks ago. I was cutting lots of pictures out of various newspapers and magazines, thinking about making a collage, but I had this old Vice magazine with the Vice interview with Paul Virilio, and there's this nice big picture of him, like, smiling, and he looks amused, and... Anyway, so I had cut that out. I hadn't put it on my wall yet, but then so I heard he died, so I put it up on the wall.
Well, you would have cut him out about the time he died.
No, it was more like probably a week before. I was sitting in the folder for a bit.
Well, you know, Club 22, we kill a lot of people, and that was probably you, me thinking about him, and you cutting out his picture. He just couldn't take it. He couldn't survive the attention.
Nah.
Yeah, never stop. Never stop.
Okay, so Jason, what do you have to say, Jason? Have you heard anything of what we talked about?
I've only been here for, I don't know, 20 minutes or so.
Well, okay. Now, Jason's an example of someone who couldn't handle LaRouche. He's a Canadian. He's an ecologist. He's a Luddite. He works in social welfare. He just couldn't take LaRouche, right? Right, Jason?
No, I like his economics, like just the basics, but I can't take the giant industrial projects and farming fucking outer space.
You see?
Yeah, fuck that.
The industrial stuff, Jason being a TV kid or satellite kid, can't handle the huge 19th century visual kinetic structures. Just alien to small is beautiful.
Yeah, just those huge mega projects. Like, it's tough to get that many people rallied behind it anyways.
Yeah. But they might be necessary until our technologies, if they put forth our technologies, they wouldn't be necessary.
Yeah, well, why isn't that happening?
LaRouche is suppressing us. LaRouche is our enemy.
But I should be into him, and I should be pushing him and supporting him, but he's your enemy.
Yeah, that's right. Everybody on my charts, my essay, is my enemy. McLuhan, Zappa, Thompson, Croker. I mean, remember, I started celebrating Croker a couple of years ago, and I put a fucking warp in the universe, according to Ion. I set things back so badly that Trump almost lost because me started to talk up William Irwin Thompson because he had some important quotes that fit the our products, the iCell and all that. But apparently the people I celebrate are complete assholes in relation to the Ionic agenda and should be ignored. And if Bob keeps emphasizing them, it slows everything down. So there I am, caught in the middle between Ion, the future, and
wow,
and the holy offices, the past. Do you remember, Ryan, on New Year's Eve, 1989, the 14 women had been killed in Montreal, sniped out, and I announced that all the holy offices were obsolete. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Do you do?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you should, because you went, we were doing some round table meditation thing, and when I said that, you go, wow, that's heavy.
Yeah.
And what happened, the Android meme came along and retrieved all of them. So I had to keep talking about them for another 30 years. Really, every one of them. McLuhan had a revival in the 90s. Zappa had a revival. William Irwin Thompson had a revival.
Yeah.
Croker became known as the McLuhan of the 90s. Who else is there? Joycean Society sprang up, Finnegan's Wake reading groups. LaRouche was celebrated. He got out of jail in 94, and he became big popular guy in Russia and China and all over the place. Dr. Beter didn't get so much of a revival.
No.
Herbert W. Armstrong, he died, but he left a church in chaos, and that made a lot of news for a while. Mm. And Garrett Dean died, and then the CBC did it because I wrote this obituary in the Halifax newspaper about how great Garrett was. The CBC did a documentary on him, including interviewing me. I went up to their studio in the Empire State Building. And that story was so touching for Haligonians and Dartmouthians that they ran it every Christmas Eve for the next 7 years.
What?
Yeah.
Cool.
And you can go on my timeline and listen to it, the documentary. So Garrett had a revival. Cosmic awareness, maybe, through the Internet. That's right. They got a lot of their stuff on the Internet. And all the old sessions, Dave Worster, Ralph Doobie, and all that, that got popularized, or people started to find out about them and download their whatever was available on the Internet. And so it's Cosmic Awareness, Finnegan's Wake. Yeah. Anyways, most of them. There was a great Android meme retrieval of everything. Think of that. Think of that. Meditate on it.
Yep. All past and present.
That's right. So, look, I just keep going on. Say something. You can lead the discussion here.
I read an interesting article in The Economist. Not that I read The Economist very often. Talking about how nude culture and the old world is declining.
Nude culture? NUDE?
Yeah.
nude culture in the old world. What's that?
Just talking about how the young coming up are more prudish. And the Swedish MP started off in an international sauna congress in Finland, naked we were all equal, and how a lot of business and political deals are done in saunas. And then, because, like, over the last, like, I mean, the 20th century, in Scandinavia, the focus was in the sauna. In the Mediterranean, it was the beach to, like, just go naked. And in Germany, it was everywhere. And the free body culture encourages stripping off while gardening, playing sports, taking lunch breaks. But nude beaches, resorts, topless, sunbathing, and nude unisex saunas are declining. Football teams report that players are unwilling to remove their underwear to shower after matches.
Wow. So, I was just looking at an old quote that somebody posted that I said years ago. I said that the internet culture would flip into a Victorian sensibility generation.
Yep.
So what are the millennials or whoever these kids are, what are they, what's their rationale, or do they even notice it?
Well, they don't drink as much.
It's just today, today nudist complaint says today nudist complaint is more difficult to separate nakedness from sex. French nudists say that their movement's younger members are overwhelmingly men. Women are leery of being being stared at or being completely sexualized.
In other words, people are not doing nudity in a pure asexual way.
Yeah, they go on to say, on one hand, young people nowadays watch the craziest sorts of porn, and on the other, they find it harder to take their clothes off.
Huh. Yeah, that would be a natural dialectic between the chemical body and the chip body. They have to bounce off the tensions.
Yeah.
If the norm is porn, then the individual identity assertion would be being dressed.
Say that again.
If the norm is porn in their experience, then the individualistic anti-environmental stance would be clothing.
Yeah, it makes sense for sure.
There's always that sensory ratio balancing going on.
Yeah, I thought it was a nice little inventory of effects when I read it.
Yeah. So, social mortar is language, media, and clothing, and the god of everybody, the godhead, the sovereign self, does not want to be affected by mortar. Social mortar, so always has to maintain its detachment no matter how the ratios of social mortar go. They always have to assert they're not involved with it. So the natural sovereignty of young people will create a stance opposite to the norm of porn. That's the way gods express their irritation with social mortar, social media, social language, social constraints.
Yeah, and covering up. They're trying to cover up something that they're...
Yeah, you could say they have an ego. They're always going to cover up something because they got an ego. But Ian says it's not an ego, it's their sovereign self. That's eternal. That's not embedded in local customs.
Unless you live in a small town.
Who's that calling? Would you say you got a small town?
Unless you live in a small town.
What does that lead to?
Because you can't cover up your ego.
No, you do. That's why McLuhan said small towns and villages are very violent. Familiarity
yeah, you do,
breeds
you,
contempt.
You can't. You can try, but you're...
Right.
You're going to be naked and you're going to get violent.
Right. So you do all kinds of strange strategies to be protect yourself. You probably find all kinds of weird hobbies in small towns.
Mm. Yep. Or drugs.
Yeah. Drugs now. And so urban people don't engage. Oh, are you going, Jason? You're disappearing. Everybody's leaving. Reiner just left.
Huh?
Jason just left. They disconnected. That just leaves Brian. It's going to have to innovate some conversational themes.
Oh boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well. Brian. Listen, I don't think you listen to Iron much, but Jason's back. Okay. So Jason, the small town have eccentrics, but the city, urban people, they express their eccentricity in what shows they go to, what performances, what clubs, mm-hmm. what theaters. They're consumers. The city dweller is a consumer. The small town guy, he's got nothing going on. He's got to make something. He becomes a bird watcher. A Rotarian. Member of Kiwanis.
Yeah.
Now, so you...
Yeah, small town people.
You, Jason, are a small town person, but stuck in big cities. You're paralyzed. You're in between.
Well, I find great strength in that contrast.
Right, because you haven't got any money, so you can't go out to all the clubs and shows.
I do pretty good. Lots of my friends are musicians, so I get out there.
You mean because they let you in for free?
It's not too expensive.
Hmm.
Like $20.
So you, right? So you do go. You do go.
Probably going to my friends. Like, yeah.
But you're not in a rural thing. You came from rural stuff. You're not in a rural scene now.
No, I live out in the woods. I wouldn't say like rural, not like country farming, farmland. I mean,
you're not in a small town.
In the outskirts of a small town.
Okay. Well, then you're pretty
more
rural,
like a,
pretty.
Yeah, for sure. But I work in the city.
Right. Okay. And you've gone to cities through the years in your education.
Yeah. I lived in Portland, Oregon for 4.5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So you're paralyzed. You've been urbanized.
No.
And you...
not paralyzed. I just understand, like, people in the city, they're floaters. They're not attached or have any sort of relationship to the territory.
Yeah.
To the land. Like, and when you're in a city, like, everything is concrete. You're never actually even touching the territory. You're always in, I don't know, maps, I guess.
Yeah.
The map is not the territory.
You're floating. You're floating.
Yeah.
Right.
But did you begin in a small town as a kid?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you told me that.
A small tourist town in the Rocky Mountains.
Okay, well, Rocky Mountains.
Yep.
That's, I don't know if that's isolated. Some people think it's beautiful, but it is sort of isolated, right? Up in the Rocky Mountains?
Yeah. You can pick a direction and you can walk for weeks, years, months, and never find anything.
No. Wow. Hear that, Brian?
Yeah, I believe it.
Okay, well,
yeah,
I'm going to play some Ion. I got a lot to play tonight. This first one is not the 4X. It's a bunch of other complex scientific stuff with Carolyn and me. If you're inclined, you might find it interesting. But
cool.
I don't think Brian will stay. So Brian,
I will likely sign off before it's done anyway. So
yeah, because you got to sleep.
Yep.
So I think we did a great analysis of the conference. We'll put that out and promote it, see if anybody dares listen to it.
Cool.
I put some embeds in there I want them to hear. And we'll see. But I guarantee none of the people who spoke will comment on it. They're not allowed to.
Oh, who knows? Maybe one or two.
I doubt it. We might get an insult from Alex Kuskus, who was pissed off at the whole conference.
I met him as well.
Oh.
So that was, yeah. And we didn't exactly, I couldn't say that we worked it out because we didn't, like, get into it, but we, like, agreed to shrug it off, so.
To shrug what off?
Well, there was some, like, tension there.
Okay, does he know that you got kicked off? Did he know that?
Oh, yeah, he knew who I was.
And he knew that you got kicked off with me back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, how about, you know, I haven't lobbied him yet, but why not have you back on? Did you ask to be back on, or how did you ignore the knowing?
I can be back on now.
Awesome. Why, just because you were there and showed you were sane?
I guess, yeah. And
well, how did he indicate? How did he know who you were?
Well, it's funny. I wasn't like, it's funny, this thing at these conferences with these name tags.
Oh, yeah.
But then it's funny because I was talking, like, he was standing in front of me for a while, but I didn't clue in. It was like, I don't know, he doesn't necessarily resemble his Facebook profile picture that much, I didn't think, or something. I didn't clue in. But, anyway, just that he's, like, wearing a name tag that says his name, but he's also, at the time that I met him, like, holding a plate of food right in front of it. That it's, like, it's just funny at these conferences that the name tags hang exactly at the same height that you would typically hold your little plate of food, so it blocks them anyway. But, you know, anyway.
So you didn't know who he was at first?
No.
So you were talking to him anyways?
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And then he, how did you guys, how did he acknowledge that he knew you?
I was there with Nigel as well. And, Nigel said hello first. And Sam was like, oh, and he just, I don't know. He just, I don't remember exactly how he acknowledged. It was, he didn't, I didn't get a bad vibe at any point. So.
Right. So once he realized who you are, you then, did you request to be let back on?
I guess not exactly. I can't really reconstruct that conversation because that was also, like, you know, after the, like, bar had opened. So I don't really know.
Right. So the point is that it got acknowledged. He said you can get back on. Well, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to meet people in person if you've had extensive interaction with them online. It's like, yeah, that can be distorting.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah. No, it's good. But yeah.
Yeah, I won't In our recording of the conference, what we just had, I won't include this. I'll stop it, you know, 10 minutes ago or 20 minutes ago.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, this won't be part of it. So, that said,
it did. it did fit. The whole thing did finish up with one last thing that I only just noticed now tonight while I was looking at the notes. It kind of finished up with a sort of a reversal or a contradiction of the opening. The final, the keynote speaker, one of his themes or one of the things that he came around to saying, to begin with, the person who represented, not representing UNESCO, but representing like the committee that recommended this library
yeah.
to UNESCO for designation, they made this point that they said because it's the memory of the world designation.
Yeah.
She said that safeguarding the memory of the world is considered essential to peace.
To who?
So
to who?
Peace. To peace.
Oh, to peace. Okay.
That's why it's like a UN mandate. That's why it's like within their purview.
You know? Right.
And that's an interesting point. But that I only just realized looking and flipping back and forth of these notes tonight that the keynote speaker, one of his points was about forgetting and the importance of forgetting. And he actually said, he was like, don't universal love and forgetting go together?
Yeah.
And, so I didn't realize that kind of, so there was a bit of a reversal over the course of the whole from the beginning to the end of the program that way.
Right. And Alex took that spirit since it was the last of the conference, and he said, sure. Yeah, I'll forgive you. I'll forget.
Yeah.
And, forget. You know, it wasn't so much him. It was Martin Speer who was all irritable.
It didn't help that, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just a one-on-one kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's all whatever.
Well, that's good.
No.
Is yeah. Nigel get back on, too?
I believe so.
So do you have to formally...
No, he's already back on. No, Nigel and Alex are already okay. That was the thing.
Okay.
It was just me that I had, like, declined to be... it was like, no, I'm not going to... I kind of said, like, I'm not going to promise to be civil.
Right.
You're not going to admit wrongdoing or something. Anyway, so, yeah, no, Nigel was already, he was already okay.
Right, because you have to reapply, because you got deleted in a very deep way by Martin. He fucked it up, and so it was hard to, Alex, to get people back on. At least it was with me, so... You might have to fill out the form again, answer a few questions.
Hmm.
It's like you're not, you won't even register. You can't even get registered. You may not be able to get on and see this. I couldn't get to the form.
Hmm.
So you haven't gone there in a long while. You may find you can't get in there, and I don't know what you do. You have to get Alex to do something.
Okay, yeah, well.
Ask Nigel what he had to do.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm sure this is of universal interest to everybody on the planet. But all good things must end. So,
sure. Well, hey, there's a good recording coming up, right?
Yes. Ion, you mean?
Cool. Yeah, yeah.
Yep, this is, you just can't believe the topics that we do, especially with Carol. So, enjoy the Harold Channer thing, and tell me any responses. And that was a good idea to call in and report on the conference. Very good.
Cool. Yeah, it was fun. Good. Good talking to you, Bob.
Okay,
bye. We got it down there. I appreciate them putting it together. So you know, you got to respond.
Yeah. Okay. Great. All right. So Jason.
Cheers.
Jason might hang around. He might be available to talk later.
How long is this talk that you're putting on?
About an hour.
All right.
Okay, see you, Brian.
Good night, Bob. Night, Jason.
Yeah.
Good night.
Okay. I will mute Sean, someone else, and Jason. And we'll start playing this. It is... recorded November 2nd, 2011. So Ion will be gone for his first two-year break 3 weeks or 4 weeks later from this recording. So this is one of the final recordings of the first phase. Private sessions with me and Carolyn. We went on to have private sessions during Ion's public fast, but this is one that involves the public. Ion has not left yet. So here we go. And this is November 2nd, 2011.
Tell me about gigalometry. Is it giggle as in G-I-G-G-L-E-ometry?
Yeah, gigalometry. Uh-huh.
Tell me about it.
No, we like it when Bob says that we can giggle. It always makes us laugh. Gigalometry. Like the Dalai Lama. Gigalometry.
Well, he didn't even think it was giggle. He thought it was giga, G-I-G-A. I mean, he had it totally wrong. So you were laughing at him saying the wrong word the wrong way.
Yeah, oh, yeah, we do that. We just love that about Bob. It just tickles the shit out of us, and we tell him it. And no matter what we tell him, he says it. And then we giggle, and he says, oh, that's what you said. And then he says it another way. And then we giggle at that, and then he says it another way. So it's like, well, it's like, if you want to do it from giga, that's fine. But then you say giga, then you say Dalai Lama, and then try again. So gigalometry is just a flow. Makes no difference if you call it giga or giggle, but you wouldn't say gigalima, it's gigalama. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, there was something when Bob and I were going over the session 399.
Melting titanium, yes, we were there.
He was saying neutrinos don't share electrons. He was reminding us of that. They don't get involved. And he said...
Bob or us?
Bob was saying neutrinos don't share electrons. And actually, that's the definition.
He'd know that.
And he wondered if neutrinos are ascended.
No. Do they represent ascended people when the electrons...
Maybe, yes.
People?
They very well might. They very well likely might. They very like. It's a best working example, Bob. It's a good way. If you're going to talk to us, put your headphones on. You don't have to put the mute on. I mean, you don't have to talk, but you need to hear.
He's hearing.
No, I can hear, and I can eat and all that, and you don't mind.
Oh,
let me just clarify.
Please,
you know what you're going to answer.
Mind.
I said the electrons and the interaction of the subatomic particles mime the behavior of people in crowds.
Mime. Okay, mime, yeah.
Mime, yeah, mime. So I thought, who would be a person in a group who's among the group but is not affected by it? And I remember the neutrinos were not something not sharing charges. They were not affected, get charged. They're not affected by charges. So they represent the ascended person among the 99%ers.
Mm.
Yeah, and you must use it as represent. Because if you go at it any other way, we're going to say, hell no. It's like all other analogies. Sooner or later, they suck. But as a representation, that's how you can fit a god in Bel Air and be normal.
Right. Okay.
Because of a tachyonic ramification.
Hey, Kim, I sort of heard it. Earnest. Something are, that's past. Something can only be tachyonic. Tachyonic is what we're moving towards to understand, because that's what ourness refers. There is no past.
Well, that's what you're gauging. That's what you're gazing truth by.
Gauging truth by. The past.
Yeah. Well, the future past.
What will be the future past, you know?
Okay. Oh, sorry.
A past situation, the three, you got the past. We're always in the past, so... So there's the past, the present past, and then the future past. Is that what the future is?
Okay. Today is whatever day it is. Right, Bob?
Yeah.
Okay. The sun rises in your world most days, does it not?
Of course. Come on. We know that.
Well, with you, we don't leave anything. We take it line by line.
That's right. Okay. I'll agree with that.
Yeah, good. Okay. You can get a suntan from getting too much sun next Saturday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And see, because you accept the truth that the sun's going to rise every day. So much so that you can get a sunburn today from sun that's going to come up on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so you say, no, 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 I can't possibly get a sunburn from a sunrise. It's going to happen 2 days from today. And we go, you most certainly do and can. If you look really, really close or get really white sheets, you'll see the redness be the day before you go get the sun. Now, you don't feel it yet, but look at the body closely.
Done. Okay, just to finish up, about
it's the thing about vitamin D. It doesn't. It's already there until it gets activated by the sunshine. You don't get vitamin D from the sun.
Yeah, so Karen, I didn't understand any of that, and we're not pursuing it, Carol.
Right, I have to
know. No, just a minute, Ian. Did you, Carol, know noon hour where polarity is in the angel diagram and where which one was in the Escher ring? Did you note that?
I don't think so.
Well, I'll just... for some reason, I thought polarity would be in the inner chemistry for six rings because that's where electrons are in chemistry and sharing of electrons.
No.
Okay, so that, and then I thought, okay, therefore the Escher is magnesium. But and then Ian corrected me.
Magnesium? What the fuck are you talking about?
Magnetism.
So oh, then, magnetism.
Yeah.
Well, you say magnesium
hey, come
in the
on.
Presence of Dr. Dean, and you're a different world.
Yeah. So Ian said it was reversed, I think. So polarity would be in the Escher, and magnetism would be in the first six rings. So,
absolutely.
Outer six
rings.
No, outer six rings is frequency.
Okay.
That's the outer kingdom, okay? Inner six rings were RNA and DNA. You want to change that? You're saying the outer six rings?
No. We're going to say more times than not, from a cellular strata, you're going to find they're interchangeable.
Right, which you implied. You said frequency at one point is it could be the whole cell, and the inner rings can be the whole thing. So, becoming, we collapse the dialectic, the dichotomy.
Well, when you added movement, then that's correct. But you're not asking from that construct. You're just trying to get the simplest, basal
right, looking at the stable
picture.
Image. So a good point is that I'm missing the point. It's moving. And these positionings don't work when it's all moving.
But if you get the base, you know what's moving into and what's moving out from. And sometimes that it helps you, not significantly this moment, but it will help you when you're getting tangled up in shit in your future. Then you'll notice that those shifts came from somewhere. See? And so if you know where you're from, then where you get to, you'll recognize yourself. So it's okay to apply those different positions to the place as long as you know that you're always going to keep a bag packed.
Right, and changes will happen, you mean?
Well, the shifts, you'll recognize the shifts easier if you know where they started from. But you're right, if you didn't get which was which, and then they moved, then you'd really be screwed, see?
Okay. So what's interesting, so for the stable, flat image of the angel diagram, in that context, the Escher deals with its polarity. Polarity deals with the direction you're taking in, and that would be the 14 degrees of freedom.
Yep.
So the 14 degrees of freedom are in the Escher ring.
And that has nothing to do with magnetism, and that's where everybody gets. No, you don't say you know. If we say something, we're trying to get something on the record.
They're thinking of magnetism as attracting, and magnetism
right,
pushes
away. Right, and it repels. Very good.
Right, yeah. So when I look at the chemistry, the inner six rings as magnetism, which is the isness, I think you said that the magnetism more the isness, that, and I was thinking on the way home from the beach, the cells and the inner chemistry is given. Isness is what's been given to us, or what's...
it's what
upon.
Is.
What is, based on outer sources of information. Right?
That you recognize as is, right.
Yeah, our culture sufficiently got resonant with the chemical scientists' work over the last 150 years and said, well, okay, they're finding something that, and that'll be our is. Then the frequency.
Right, like we said, in the best example with what Carolyn and I have been working on tonight is no one ever died of cancer until they discovered it.
Right. That would be the frequency factor.
Well, yeah, but see, if